We'll go ahead and jump into Ezra chapter 7, because that's where we left off last time. I apologize if you have not been able to hear parts 1 through 5, but they weren't that good anyway, so don't worry about it. No, they are available on the website to pick up lost pieces if you have missed them along the way. As we closed out chapter 6, we had specifically discussed this issue of the holy days being reinstituted as a national celebration there in Judah and Jerusalem. And one of the things we mentioned that was an important understanding, a change that had taken place in Israel, or in Judah, was that the Passover became an institutional celebration as opposed to a personal celebration. All the lambs were then slaughtered by the priests at the temple area, which was a major change from the way things went. Somewhere, we believe, between Ezra's time and the time of Christ is when that transition probably took place of eating the Passover very possibly on the 15th day instead of the 14th day, the way the Jews do it today, of course, is they eat the Passover on the 15th, on the first day of unleavened bread. And that may have developed during these several hundred years in this intertestamental period between the time of Ezra and the time of Christ. During that time is likely when this had developed, just because of the volume of lambs that had to be killed in order to prepare the Passover for everyone. So from this time forward, apparently the lambs were all being killed at the temple by the priests instead of by individual families, the way it had been prescribed in the book of Leviticus. We also mentioned, of course, that we made a reference to Haggai 2 and verse 9, where the prophet Haggai talks about the glory of this second temple, this latter house, will be greater than the glory of the first house. And we talked about how difficult that was, in one sense, to comprehend, because Solomon's temple was far more physically glorious than this particular temple that Ezra and Nehemiah and the folks of that generation were building. But the fact that Christ himself, in the person, God in the flesh, came to this temple, that obviously gives it a greater glory in one sense than the previous temple, where only God's Shekinah glory, in other words, this manifestation, but not Christ himself, not God in the flesh coming there. So with that, we come into chapter 7, where we had left off, and we jump ahead approximately 30 years between chapter 6 and chapter 7. And if you like to make notes in your Bible or just keep notes in your head, this period between chapter 6 and chapter 7 is where the story of Esther would fit in chronologically. So we go from one king in Ezra chapter 6, we completely skip Ahasuerus, and we come into chapter 7 with Artaxerxes. So that whole period of the book of Esther is covered in that book, and Ezra doesn't mention anything about it here. That's over in the book of Esther. So if you like to make notes of those things, that's fine. Chapter 6 basically ends about 515, and chapter 7 picks up about 557, something like that. So quite a gap in there. Verse 1 says, "Now after these things, in the reign of Artaxerxes," this is, we understand, probably Artaxerxes the first. There were more of them to follow later. "He was king of Persia, Ezra, the son of Sariah, the son of Azariah, the son of Hilkiah." He goes down now, and Ezra, we kind of meet him for the first time, where now his pedigree is given. And it lists his descendants all the way back to Aaron himself. So we know that Ezra was not only a Levite, he was also from the family of Aaron. He was an Aaronite, we might say, so that made him a priest. But it describes him also a little bit differently in verse 6. "This Ezra," the one whose genealogy we just would have seen in verses 2, 3, 4, and 5, "this Ezra went up from Babylon, and he was a ready scribe in the law of Moses," is the way that the King James puts it. A ready scribe simply means a skilled scribe, a well-versed scribe. Now, scribes were individuals. Not all priests were scribes. In fact, as time went on, most scribes were not priests at all. And the art of scribing takes a higher and higher role as the next couple hundred years go on. And there's a couple reasons for that. First of all, scribes were well known for their attention to detail, very meticulous. A couple hundred years later, when Christ addresses the law of God and how important it is and how it was going to remain, he said, "Not one jot or tittle shall in any wise pass from the law till all things be fulfilled." So he was using these scribal, these smallest of scribal notations to say the law of God is going to remain. Scribes were trusted individuals in a large part because of their intense attention to detail, whereas the priesthood was often seen as going off the deep end, falling into paganism, misleading people. The scribes were seen, well, how can you have such detailed knowledge of God's law and not be someone to look up to and follow? Now, the interesting thing is that, again, the scribal role grew in Judah, even while the priestly role kind of declined. Now, when you come to the time of Christ, about 500 years later, what do you find? Usually the word scribe is paired with what? Pharisees, scribes and Pharisees. So you have this intense attention to detail, and they were looked up to by the common person far more than even the priests, because they had this detailed knowledge. Now, that doesn't mean it was in perspective. Sometimes people who have great detailed knowledge do not have very good perspective because they're concentrating on the detail. So Christ would mention things like, you're straining at a gnat but swallowing a camel. You're paying attention to little details. You miss the whole point. Today we would say, you miss the forest for the trees. In other words, you're standing so close to the tree, you see the bark and the detail and the little bugs that are crawling on it, but you forget the fact that you're in this giant forest and what part that plays in the whole ecosystem, etc. So scribal duties, very detailed, very meticulous. They were trained in studying God's law, copying God's law, had a very intricate system of how to copy God's law, how to count letters to be sure that every word was spelled correctly and in the right place, in the right order, very detailed system. But Ezra was one of those skilled scribes, as well as being a priest, as well as being, in one sense, a moral leader of Judah at this time. In some areas, not in the scripture, but some writings about Ezra, he's referred to as the second Moses because of his attention to the detail of God's law, and also because he led this second wave of immigrants out of Babylon to Jerusalem. This was a much smaller migration or immigration than the first one with Zerubbabel, but nonetheless, it was significant because it came with the backing of the Persian Empire as well as a great deal of funding for the temple and for the priesthood, for the whole service of the temple. So Ezra taught the law of God faithfully, referred to as the second Moses, and this office of scribe would be something that would continue to grow in importance in Judah right through the time of Christ. Apparently, Ezra made a formal request to the king, and the king approved it, and we'll go through that as we move on from verse 6. So again, in verse 6, this Ezra went up from Babylon. He was a ready scribe in the law of Moses, which the eternal God of Israel had given, and the king granted him all his request according to the hand of the Lord his God upon him. Certainly, we are well aware that oftentimes men in political office do not write their own material because there's just so much to do. Now, we've had some pleasant experiences with that. We've had some very unpleasant experiences with that. But nonetheless, can we really expect that Artaxerxes took the time to write all of the things in the next few verses himself? Did he come up with this himself? Probably not. We find here that Ezra made a request. So it's very likely that maybe Ezra actually wrote what was here, presented it to the advisors, to the king, and eventually the king signs off on it. That's certainly a reasonable understanding of this. Now, it's possible that Artaxerxes sat down and wrote all this out, because when it comes to the actual words of the letter beginning in verse 11, they're actually written in Aramaic. So we're in Hebrew up to that point. We go through the official decree or letter, then down to verse 27. We go back to the Hebrew again in the original text. So it's possible that Artaxerxes wrote these things, but more likely than not, Ezra saw this as an opportunity, presented it, God blessed it, opened the minds of the counselors and the king, and it was approved. Now we'll pause for a second there, because obviously, and again, you hate to be too rude, but outside critics often look for excuses not to believe the Bible. And when you go through this section, you'll find Ezra very clearly says, God opened this door for us. He made it possible for us. Critics would say, it has nothing to do with it. The king just wanted an ally, a friendly people in Jerusalem, because he was having problems with not just the Greeks, he was having problems with the Egyptians as well. And he realized that if he has an ally in Judea, and he has that land bridge that's so important for troops getting down to Egypt, that it would be important. Well, that certainly may have been part of the political situation at the time. At the same time, God often uses these circumstances to work His will. So we view world events through God's eyes as much as possible. Other critics tend to view world events and then say, oh, that's why that happened. So there was an open door here that Artaxerxes did want an ally in that area, or friendly people at the very least. But God has a way of structuring those things. We know He's ultimately in control. at the end of verse 6, it says, according to the hand of the Lord his God upon him. Verse 7 says, and there went up some of the children of Israel, and of the priests, and the Levites, the singers, the porters, the Nethinims, unto Jerusalem in the seventh year of Artaxerxes the king. So we would understand this year to be 457 B.C. So it's at this point that Ezra leads this second major wave of captives back to the area of Jerusalem. Now again, it's hard to know how many of the original captives would have possibly been alive and strong enough at this point in time to make their way back to Jerusalem. It is extremely unlikely that any first-generation individuals were still alive at this point making this trip. Because if we're talking, in the 580s probably, we'd have to have, the original captivity of Jerusalem. We would have to have someone, over 100 years old making this trek back. So these are now second or possibly third, maybe even fourth generation individuals. So many in Ezra's group would have lived their entire lives in Babylon and now are making the trek back. And there's a certain zeal to that we're going to go claim what our ancestors once held. So you can understand this excitement that would have been a part of this group as they make their trek back to Judah, to Jerusalem. Verse 8, he came to Jerusalem in the fifth month, which was in the seventh year of the king. And I will say, just for passing, there is controversy as to, are these the Jewish recollections of months or are these the Babylonian recollections of months? There was the sacred year that began, of course, in Abib with the first month in the spring. But there was also the civil year in Babylon that began in Tishri right after the feast, or about the time of the feast. So some say this was in the spring. They left in the spring, arrived in May. Others say, no, they left in the fall, arrived in the spring. It doesn't really matter one way or the other. Point is, we do understand the year that's involved, the seventh year of the king. So that makes it clear whether it was the spring or fall really is not a great deal of difference. We should also mention that when we talk about these migrations of individuals from Babylon back to Jerusalem, we're talking about a very small group of people overall. The vast, vast majority of Jews stayed in Babylon and the surrounding areas. They were already established. They lived there. A very small group by comparison came back to Judea, even with all three of these migrations, the next one that comes later on in the book. small groups of people. To this day, well, there were probably more people, for example, that emigrated to Israel in the last 60 or 70 years by far than ever emigrated back at this time. To this day, if I understand correctly, there are more Jews still in New York City than there are in the entire nation of Israel. So most Jews, even to this day, do not live in this area, and that was the case at this time. It was a small representative group. A lot of people gave offerings to send with the immigrants, but they weren't going to go themselves to uproot their family to a new land. So we have really, in one sense, a group of pioneers, the people with a pioneering spirit, willing to take on whatever comes their way. So a unique group of people in that sense actually made the trip. So verse 9, upon the first day of the first month, he began he to go up from Babylon. And again, some would say that's the civil year. Others believe it's the sacred year. I think there are good arguments for both. On one hand, would Ezra be leaving 2 weeks before the Passover? Maybe not. Maybe he'd want to stay for the Passover, take care of that, then leave in the fall after the feast. Maybe. At the same time, what better time to start out? It's a new year, it's spring, let's go. So it's really impossible, I think, to determine one way or the other. I guess I lean at this point more toward the sacred year. It's first month, first day. It's probably he just left at the beginning of the year. Let's make a fresh start and go for it. You can keep the Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread anywhere. It may have been significant in their mind. We're going to be traveling on the road, keeping the Days of Unleavened Bread, just like the original Israelites when they left Egypt. So maybe that would be part of it. Nonetheless, it says at the end of the verse, according to the good hand of his God upon him. And you have to ask, why was God's hand upon Ezra? Verse 10 probably tells us. Ezra had prepared his heart to seek the law of the Eternal. Now, again, my personal opinion is that Ezra was the first in a long time to have a great passion and detail for God's law. And again, my personal opinion is some who came after him took that passion for detail in God's law to another higher degree in the sense of introducing this concept of Pharisaism, that the details became so important that the overall principles were lost along the way. So yeah, you could dedicate things to God even if your parents are starving. Well, sorry, Mom, I'd like to feed you this week, but I dedicate this money to God every week. I've got to give this money to God. Sorry, I can't help you there. Well, wait a second. So that's my personal feeling, is that that's where that trend began, because Ezra certainly seems to be full of zeal and detail and perspective, but the detail seems to take over in the next couple hundred years until the time of Christ, when we have people who have great attention to detail but no judgment whatsoever. So because Ezra prepared his heart to seek the law of the Lord and to do it and to teach in Israel statutes and judgments. We might say that Ezra sat upon a three-legged stool, one that we should all do well to learn from. Ezra sought the law of God. It's important that we seek God's law. You don't stop there. We don't stop there. Then it says the second leg of the stool, to do it. So you have seeking God's word, God's will, God's law, correct understanding. Then it's of little use unless we do it, we apply it. So seeking, doing, and then to teach in Israel statutes and judgments. So seek and do and teach were the three legs of the stool that gave Ezra God's blessing, that God blessed him as a result. Others have put this same concept as know the way, go the way, and show the way. So we have a responsibility to learn God's way, live God's way, and then pass it on to others as we have the opportunity. Know the way, go the way, and show the way, or seek, do, and teach. Those are basic Christian responsibilities. Christians in the New Testament clearly learned God's way, they lived God's way, and then what did they do? They preached the gospel. They taught it to others as they had the opportunity. And we have that same responsibility now. In verse 11 begins the actual decree that was signed off by Artaxerxes to allow Ezra and the immigrants to come back to Judah. And that runs all the way through verse 26. like to read through some of that with you in verse 11. Now this is the copy of the letter that King Artaxerxes gave unto Ezra the priest, the scribe, even a scribe of the words of the commandments of the Eternal and his statutes to Israel. We should pause for at least one note. Scribes were not strictly individuals who dealt with the Word of God. And this is one of those occasions where it emphasizes that Ezra was not just a secretary in the royal court, because there were scribes there who wrote letters and official documentation, and then it was sent out and it was taken. There were scribes who recorded business transactions and things like that. The kind of scribe that Ezra was a scribe in the law of God. So Artaxerxes gives this letter to Ezra. Again, my personal opinion is Ezra probably wrote it, ran it through the system. The king finally signed it and passed off on it because it was not only good for him, it was good for everybody involved. Verse 12. And now again, maybe I'm being a skeptic. Now maybe Artaxerxes was this close to being converted and really did worship the true God. That would be wonderful. If we see him in the first resurrection, I'll say, "Hey, Artie, good to see you, buddy." But something tells me second resurrection is more likely. And we'll still say hello, Artie, maybe. I don't know. Verse 12, Artaxerxes, king of kings, unto Ezra the priest, the scribe of the law of the God of heaven, perfect peace at such a time. I make a decree that all they of the people of Israel and the priests and the Levites in my realm, which are minded of their own free will to go up to Jerusalem, go with you. This is one of the phrases that makes most scholars think Ezra probably wrote this. Because would Artaxerxes have the understanding of the delineation between priests and Levites? As king of Persia, probably not. Of this minor religious sect, hundreds of miles away, thousands of miles away. Would he really have that kind of? Probably not. So somebody else probably wrote it. He read through it and signed off on it at some point. But he makes this decree that the priests, the Levites of my realm, which have a mind of their own free will, go up to Jerusalem, go with you. In other words, gives Ezra permission to get this contingent together. So one thing I think is probably the case here is that Ezra saw a need, wanted to see God honored, wanted to see the temple continue to be developed and beautified and upgraded, and it was his desire to do this. And then he recruits people. I'm not sure that there was this great movement of people who, oh, let's all go back. Ezra was the spark plug here, no doubt. Verse 14, for as much as you are sent of the king and of his seven counselors to inquire concerning Judah and Jerusalem according to the law of your God, which is in your hand, and to carry silver and gold, which the king and his counselors have freely offered unto the God of Israel, whose habitation is in Jerusalem. So the king is actually funding part of this. Yes, lots of free will offerings from Jews in the provinces there, but the king is actually going to fund some of this out of tax revenue as well. Wouldn't it be great if President Obama called us up and said, you know, we've got plenty of tax money laying around. We'd like you to use some of it to preach the gospel. Okay, that's complete fantasy, but... Not a little bit unlike what happened here. Here's the king of Persia saying, yes, we want tax money to go to this. Verse 16, all the silver and gold that you can find in all the province of Babylon. What does that mean? Anyone who's willing to donate. It wasn't that Ezra just sent people out looking for coins on the ground or digging mines or things like that. Whatever you can rustle up is his point. Whatever you can get donated. Find in the province of Babylon with the free will offering of the people and of the priests, offering willingly for the house of their God, which is in Jerusalem. And again, we said that very few people actually left and went to Jerusalem, but huge donations came in. I mean, huge donations. We'll see that in a few minutes. Verse 17, that you may buy speedily with this money bullocks, rams, lambs with their meat offerings and their drink offerings, and offer them upon the altar of the house of your God, which is in Jerusalem. So apparently Artaxerxes really wanted to see the people happy there. He wanted to see this God honored because he thought it would be good for him. So in one sense, he's resurrecting or reemphasizing the policy of one of his progenitors, Cyrus, had to encourage these local religions because he felt it would be good for him in the long run. Verse 18, whatsoever shall seem good to you and to your brethren to do with the rest of the silver and gold, that do after the will of your God. So Ezra's given a great deal of trust. Make sure the sacrificial system is back in order so that your God is honored. And whatever you need to do with the rest of the money, go ahead and do it. A tremendous amount of trust here. Verse 19, the vessels also that are given you for the service of the house of your God, those deliver you before the God of Jerusalem. So there was also stuff for the temple service, plates, cups, dishes, bowls, all these kinds of things. All those, make sure they get there as well. Verse 20, whatsoever more shall be needful for the house of your God, which you shall have occasion to bestow, bestow it out of the king's treasure house. So if you need more, the tax dollars are there. Go ahead and tap them. And then it tells, oh, by the way, there is a limit of how much you can tap, but tax monies would be available. Verse 21, and I, even Artaxerxes the king, do make a decree to all the treasurers which are beyond the river. And of course, this would have been a letter that Ezra would have had to carry, or his representatives carry to each of these treasuries. So we might liken it to our local IRS office. Take a letter in. Oh, here's a letter from President Obama. He says, I can draw out $75,000 to preach the gospel and to be, you know. Ain't going to happen today, is it? But Ezra had permission to tap the treasuries. I make a decree to all the treasurers which are beyond the river that whatsoever Ezra the priest, the scribe of the law of God of heaven, shall require of you, it be done speedily. So a great deal of authority was given to Ezra as well. Then here's the limit, up to 100 talents of silver, 100 measures of wheat, 100 baths of wine, 100 baths of oil, and salt without prescribing how much. Whatever he needs as far as salt is. In other words, feed these people as well. So this temple is restored, is improved, and the service goes forward. Verse 23, whatsoever is commanded by the God of heaven, let it be diligently done for the house of the God of heaven. For why should there be wrath against the realm of the king and his sons? So it gives a slight indication again that they weren't necessarily worshiping this God, but they didn't want this God to be mad at them either. So they figured if he's happy, he'll bless them in the long run. So again, I don't think, and most scholars don't, that somehow Artaxerxes became a worshiper of the true God. But it was one of many he wanted to be pleasing to and not make mad. Verse 24, also we certify you that touching any of the priests and the Levites, the singers, the porters, the Nethinims, or ministers of this house of God, it shall not be lawful to impose toll, tribute, or custom upon them. Now again, I try to look at the reality of some of these circumstances, and I can see Ezra writing this. See, how much can I get approved? Okay, let's go ahead and put in there the treasury thing. Let's say 100, what do you think, 100 baths of oil? Let's put that on there. And then he gets down to this point. You know, in the perfect world, I mean, the Levites are going to be carrying all this treasure back and forth and responsible for it. Let's put it in there. No tax or toll upon the Levites, or the priests and the workers of the temple. You know, typical of government. If there's money around, they want it. They want their tax share. So I can see Ezra writing this in and say, well, let's put it in, see if it goes. It would be great. Well, he approved it. And I can see Ezra just kind of, yes, all right, got that approved. Because again, the amount of money here is huge. And a tax or a toll as this goes over somebody's border is going to be diminishing the amount that could be used to do the work. Verse 25, and you, Ezra, after the wisdom of your God that is in your hand, set magistrates and judges, which may judge all the people that are beyond the river, all such as know the laws of your God, and teach them that know them not. In other words, he's not being given authority to rule this area of territory. He's given authority to train teachers and set them up so that people can be educated in this way. So, in essence, what we see is a political approval for a very tight centralization in regard to the way God's law would be kept and the way it would be interpreted. We'll talk later on in a future Bible study about what's called the Great Synagogue that was led by Ezra, which is a great centralization of God's law in the way it was interpreted, the way it was looked at. And again, we'll talk more about that later on. But even the king gives him that kind of authority to be the source, that if anyone needs to know anything about this God, about Judaism, Ezra and his magistrates or his teachers are the source for that actual knowledge. Verse 26 finishes out the letter, "And whosoever will not do the law of your God and the law of the king, let judgment be executed speedily upon him, whether it be unto death or to banishment or to confiscation of goods or to imprisonment." So they would be the authority. And if people didn't follow this, as Ezra had had mentioned it, then they would be subject to penalties and difficulties. So a great deal of authority and power was given, obviously, to Ezra to carry forward in this great responsibility of making sure that the temple was up and running properly. We'll try to get through verse 8 in just the next few minutes. Shouldn't be difficult to do because most of the chapter is a genealogy. If we look at chapter 8, well, maybe we should finish up chapter 7 first. We have two verses there, sorry. I'm looking at the watch saying, oh, I started late, I gotta go. Okay, we'll quit at the end of verse 7, or chapter 7. Maybe. Verse 27 then reverts back to the Hebrew language in the original texts, at least the copies we have, and then kind of gives Ezra's personal view through chapter 7, end of chapter 7, beginning chapter 8 and into chapter 9. Sometimes that section is referred to as the Ezra memoirs because it's kind of his personal interpretation, his personal feelings on what's going on. And he says, "Blessed be the Lord God of our fathers, which has put such a thing as this in the king's heart, to beautify the house of the Eternal, which is in Jerusalem, and has extended mercy unto me before the king and his counselors, and before all the king's mighty princes. And I was strengthened as the hand of the Eternal my God was upon me. And I gathered together out of Israel chief men to go up with me." And that's where we get the sense that this was Ezra's idea, Ezra's leadership, and then he goes out to recruit people and give them the vision. And certainly that's the point of real leadership, is to cast the vision. And then the rest of us can jump on the bandwagon and say, yes, that's where we need to go. That's what we need to do. When leadership is not given that opportunity and not responded to in that way, it can be very devastating. Chapter 8 then, "These are now the chief of their fathers, and this is the genealogy of them that went up with me from Babylon in the reign of Artaxerxes the king." And so from that point on in verse 2 down through verse 13, 14, we have this list of individuals that traveled back with Ezra. Again, a much smaller list than in the first immigration with Zerubbabel, but nonetheless an important one, not just because it was a refreshing, but also a great deal of finance was injected into the situation. In verse 15, "I gather them together to the river that runs to Ahava, and there abode we in tents 3 days. And I viewed the people and the priests and found none of the sons of Levi." So basically, Ezra would have announced, here's where we're meeting, here's the day we're meeting, here's the camp location, we're going to set up camp, we'll get organized, and we'll take off. So as he numbers the people, how many people are traveling, who all showed up, he finds out that there are no Levites. Now you might remember from the first immigration that there were very few Levites in that group as well. So if no Levites went along this time, he didn't see how possibly the temple service could get back up and running or stay up and running the way it was supposed to. And so he sets out to, in essence, put out a call for Levites, you know, calling all Levites. Come to Ahava, we want you to come with us to Jerusalem. And again, you have to remember that this is a second or third generation, so these people have only known Babylon. That's where they've lived their whole lives. Oh, they have stories about the old country, but not any personal experience, a lot of them. So they're putting out this call to bring these people on. Verse 16, "I sent for Eleazar." And it goes on down through the list of individuals that he talked to specifically. Verse 17, "I sent them with commandment to Iddo, the chief of the palace at Casiphia. And I told them what they should say to Iddo and to his brethren, the Nethinims." So basically, he's going on this recruiting mission to bring the Levites along on the trip. Now remember, the Nethinims were individuals all the way back from the time of Joshua. They were Canaanites who tricked Israel, saying, "We're from a very long way away. We don't live anywhere near here." Of course, they were next door neighbors. And they tricked Joshua into allowing them to have a peace treaty. "We won't kill you. We'll be friends." And then he finds out they're next door neighbors. So it didn't kill them, but made them servants of the Levites. So you have the priests, then their servants, their caretakers, the Levites, and then the caretakers of the caretakers. The Nethinims were the physical work of a lot of the temple services. And so they hoped that they would come likewise along with the new immigration to Judah. And it lists how many of each of these individuals, whether these are specific numbers of people or specific numbers of households. Heads of households, we're not told. I think most likely we're talking about heads of households with their wives and children, etc., would make the trip. Finally, it goes on, verse 20, "And of the Nethinims, whom David and the priests or princes had appointed for the service of the Levites, 220 Nethinims, all of them were expressed by name." So Ezra took a list of everyone who was planning to leave. Then before they began, verse 21, very important verse about fasting, because it reveals to us two of the primary reasons we fast before God. Verse 21, "I proclaimed a fast there at the river Ahava, that we might afflict ourselves before our God and seek of him a right way for us and for our little ones and for all our substance." Other translations render it, "We humble ourselves before God." He proclaimed a fast that we might humble ourselves. One of the primary reasons for fasting is to humble ourselves, to put ourselves in right perspective before God, to make sure that we're seeing ourselves correctly and who we really are before God. That compared to God, we're virtually, well, what does Isaiah say? All the nations are less than a drop in the bucket. So how about us as individuals? Less than a drop of a drop of a drop of a drop in the bucket. So just to humble ourselves, to put us in a right perspective. And going without food is certainly something that can very quickly help us to see just how little we really are, how feeble we are, how dependent we are on God. Second reason, then, he says, for fasting is that we might afflict ourselves to seek of him a right way. The second major purpose for fasting is shown here is to seek a right way, to beseech God to show us where he wants us to go, what he wants us to do, how he would have us go forward. And when we beseech God for that, we trust that God will answer. And then to rebel against that answer is not a wise idea at all. To try to change that idea, not a good idea. What if Ezra had said, "Well, we want to afflict our souls to see the right way," and basically it became obvious that you should go, you ought to go to the road of the Canaanites, go that direction to Jerusalem. And then other people said, "Well, look, I don't like that road to the Canaanites. We don't really have consensus on that. I think we should go a different direction." And so you have nothing but problems along the way. So you can imagine if Ezra had faced something like that, how difficult that would be. And would God have blessed them in the way that he did if they had taken that approach? So they looked to God to, first of all, humble themselves and then to seek a right way so that God would show them the way that they should go. Then he says a bit of the reason why in verse 22. "For I was ashamed to require of the king a band of soldiers and horsemen to help us against the enemy in the way." Why? "Because we'd spoken to the king, saying, 'The hand of our God is upon all them that do good, or for good, that seek him, but his power and his wrath is against all them that forsake him.'" So Ezra realized that, part of the reasoning that I used to help convince the king to let us go and to fund this was, God blesses those who please him, and he curses those who don't please him. King didn't want to curse, so it was part of the reason he probably agreed to this whole thing. So now is Ezra going to go back and say, "Well, we do trust God, but do you have a few soldiers you could spare?" It would make it look like he didn't believe what he had told the king at all. So he asked the brethren to fast, the people to fast, to ask for God's direction, because it was a dangerous trip. They would pass through several smaller borders. There was always the chance of thieves along the way, having just been outside the law far enough to raid these caravans and steal and kill. So it was something Ezra was concerned about. They knew they were going through some dangerous areas. But at the same time, you either trust God or you don't. Reminds me of a situation I remember from a number of years ago. A pastor who was visiting in a deep urban area where some of the brethren lived. And it was a very dangerous area. High crime. Strangers were not welcome. I remember the pastor telling the story about going to this person's house and knocked on the member's home, knocked on the door, and it was starting to get dark outside, and the person came to the door, stuck their head out the door, looked both ways, said, "You came here alone? It's like, you've risked your life even coming here. What are you doing here?" It always reminds me of that story here, that you either trust God to do it. If you're there doing God's work, He'll take care of you. If you're not, well, you know, it's going to be similar to the three men in the fire. If God chooses not to protect, so be it. But we trust that He'll take care of things as He sees fit. So they proclaimed a fast. They asked God to show them. They were certainly embarrassed. They couldn't ask for an army. And yet on the physical side, that was taking a great risk with there was huge amounts of money involved here that they would be carrying along. They didn't want this to be upset. So verse 23, "So we fasted and besought for our God for this, and He was entreated of us." He listened. He provided. So He provided a level of humility for them, and He also showed them the direction they should go. There certainly would have been several options as far as what roads do we go. Just like we, if we're traveling from here to Atlanta, there's a couple different directions we could go. We can go down 77, we can go down 65, you know, we'll eventually get there. Which way do we go? So God led Ezra to the correct way, and he followed that way. They diligently followed what God said, and great blessing was the result. God showed them. Now, Ezra does not tell us how God showed him. Did they then sit down after they fasted and talk about this? Did they present certain options before they fasted? Let's ask God which option He thinks. There's three roads to take us to this direction. Let's beseech God which one, and we'll talk about it afterwards and see which one God has led us to. We're not told how He determined that. But in some way, it was obvious to them, and they followed that direction, and great blessing was the result. Then in verse 24 through verse 30, we talk about, in one sense, trust. Trust and wisdom go together. In verse 24, he says, "I separated 12 of the chief of the priests," the two most notable ones, Sherebiah and Hashabiah, "and 10 of their brethren with them." And what was he going to do? He was entrusting them with this massive offering that they then would carry in the midst of this caravan all the way to Jerusalem and then check it in at the other end. So in one sense, they're at one bank. A withdrawal goes on. They stick it in their pockets. They travel 1,000 miles. They get to the bank and they unload it and deposit it again. That's the concept. So verse 25, "He weighed unto them the silver, the gold, the vessels, even the offering of the house of God, which the king and his counselors and lords and all of Israel there present had offered." So all the offering, the tax money, the vessels, the bowls, the plates, the cups that would go for use in the temple. "I even weighed under their hand 650 talents of silver and silver vessels, 100 talents, a gold, 100 talents. So we're talking 25 to 30 tons of precious metals. This is huge. This is millions of dollars in today's dollars. This is massive offering. Now, I think if I were one of the 12, I'd say, you know what? I'm not feeling so well. I think you need to get somebody else. Holding money just scares me for some reason. That's why I spend every penny I get. No, I'm kidding. But this is a lot of money to be responsible for. So these 12 had to be implicitly trusted. And yet at the same time, there was decorum here as well. They actually made a record of every single bit of this so that, and sometimes this is not done because you don't trust someone, it's done to show you can trust someone. Because when you get to the other end and you deliver exactly what's on the list, it's not because you didn't trust them, but now their trust is proven. And that's a good thing. Trust is vital to establish and to maintain in any organization, whether it's a family, whether it's a church, whether it's a business, etc. Verse 27, 20 basins of gold, 1,000 drams, 2 vessels of fine copper, precious as gold. And I said to them, you are holy. You've been set aside unto the eternal. The vessels are holy also, and the silver and gold are a freewill offering unto the eternal God of your fathers. So in essence, he's emphasizing this is God's stuff. Don't steal it, in essence, is what he's saying. You understand that. Verse 29, watch you and keep them until you weigh them before the chief of the priests and the Levites and the chief of the fathers of Israel at Jerusalem in the chambers of the house of the eternal. So taking it from Babylon, transporting it, depositing it there at the temple in Jerusalem. So took the priests, verse 30, and the Levites, the weight of the silver and the gold and the vessels to bring them unto Jerusalem, unto the house of our God. So it's wise, wisely handled. Now, why couldn't they just said, here's the stuff, go deliver it? Well, if I'm the transporter, I want to know exactly how much I have. Because I don't want someone on the other end saying, we gave you more than that. Well, no, this is really all it is. I remember the pile. It was bigger than that. Well, we've gone 5 months, how many thousands of miles or hundreds of miles? Let's weigh this out. So it was an exact measurement. Trust is very important. God's people tend to be very trusting. Once that trust is broken, it's very difficult, if not impossible sometimes, to rebuild. So that is one reason we want to be sure to uphold trust in every department, if at all possible. So verse 31, we departed from the river of Ahava on the 12th day of the first month to go to Jerusalem. And the hand of God was upon us. He delivered us from the hand of the enemy and of such as lay in wait by the way. And we came to Jerusalem and abode there 3 days. On the fourth day, the silver, the gold, the vessels weighed in the house of God by the hand of Meremoth, the son of Uriah, the priests. And with him, Eleazar, the son of Phinehas, and with them was Jozabad, the son of Jeshua, and Nodiah, the son of Binui, all Levites. By number, by weight of every one, and all the weight was written at the time. In other words, a fancy way of saying, it was exact. We didn't lose one coin on the trip. So again, that trust has to be developed. It has, in some cases, to be earned or at least supported. And these individuals were very faithful in that regard. Also, the children of those that had been carried away, which were come out of the captivity, offered burnt offerings unto the eternal God of Israel, or the God of Israel, 12 bullocks for all Israel, 96 rams, 77 lambs, 12 goats for a sin offering. All this was a burnt offering unto the eternal. So in essence, this is a thank you to God for bringing them safely and for this great blessing of the huge amounts of finances that were now infused into the situation. They delivered to the king's commissions, unto the king's lieutenants, and to the governors on this side of the river, and they furthered the people and the house of God. So they delivered these letters, and again, the whole purpose was to further the work of God, to further the people of God. And that's certainly one of the reasons we do the work together, to further the work of God, to help the people of God. Very, very important. So that brings us to the end of chapter 8. Sorry, went a little bit over time, but felt it was important to get a logical breaking point. Next time, we'll pick it up with chapter 9. Chapter 9 is an important chapter in the sense of understanding God's approach toward intermarriage of faith. Key and important topic, but we'll take the time to cover that next time. So next time, we'll pick it up with Ezra chapter 9.